welcome to the Creative Pen Podcast. I'm Joanna Penn, thriller author and professional speaker, bringing you interviews, inspiration and information on writing, publishing options and marketing ideas for your book. You can find the episode show notes, your free Author 2.0 blueprint and lots more information at thecreativepen.com, and that's pen with a double N. And here's the show. Hi everyone, I'm Joanna Penn and this is episode number 188 of the podcast, and it's the beginning of July 2014. Now today I have an interview with David Morrell, whose first novel, First Blood, became Rambo and also became part of popular culture. And we talk about, and David's also written loads more books, like 35 novels and lots of short stories and all kinds of things. He's also got a new book out for authors. So we talk about what David has learned through his life as an author. We go into his work ethic and his mindset around how short life is and what's really important, including the death of his son, the themes that are in his thrillers, and how he is actually a thrilling writer of thrillers. He believes in quote method acting, where he basically goes and learns about the exciting things he writes about, and he's my kind of idol in that way, and I follow that method myself. I love the research process. And also we talk about the business of being an author, including that David spends some time every day marketing. And if an author of his stature in the industry and, you know, with that many millions of sales, markets every day, then the rest of us sure as hell have to. But it's a brilliant interview and really inspiring to hear someone who's been in this business over 40 years, and I hope to be as energetic and enthusiastic about my writing life in 40 years as David is. I'm really excited to bring you this interview. Update from me before we get into that. I was in Barcelona for a research trip, talking of method acting, obviously not killing people, but the opening scene for the next Arcane book will be at the Sagrada Familia, which is an amazing cathedral. I mean, I walked in and I've seen the outside in pictures, but it's just stunning. And I walked in and I just had this massive grin on my face, utterly delighted by the inside of the Sagrada Familia. It's just stunning. And my photos are on Flickr, and I'll put a link in the show notes, but it doesn't really do it justice. If you do go to Spain, I highly recommend the Sagrada Familia. It's amazing. So yes, I will put a link in the show notes to the pictures in case you want to see. On translations, Pentecostes, the Spanish edition of Pentecost, is now available, and I've done a book trailer with Spanish words. So if you are a Spanish speaker, I do have some review copies of Spanish Pentecostes, so please do let me know if you'd like one. You can email joanna@thecreativepen.com. I'm going to do the book trailer also for German, and what is very cool about book trailers, of course, you know, you generally have some music and images, and that takes loads and loads of work, like a lot of work, and then the text you can easily switch out for whatever language you like. So I'm pretty thrilled that one book trailer is going to turn into four, because eventually I'll have Italian as well. So it will be Pentecost in English, German and Spanish book trailers. So very cool. The German version of Desecration is also out this month, and I've also finished Delirium. Yay! You all know how that feels. I was going to say you cannot know how good that feels, but you do know how good that feels. Finishing a difficult book is a hell of a relief. It's like I was so angry with it last month, and now I'm extremely happy to have finished it, and I'm really pleased with it. Just getting the cover sorted, and that will be out later in July. So yeah, really pleased with that. And the third one in that series is going to be called Deviance, and I'm pretty excited about that book as well. So I'm sure you guys also appreciate how amusing it is when you you just go, oh, I'm so pleased that's over. And then the next day you just start working on the next thing. And I guess this month I've been feeling very grateful, really grateful for my life and how happy I am to be living this life now. And I do get emails from people I used to work with in IT who are still doing the same job, and they're kind of going, "It, you know, it's great what you've done." And I'm like, well, it's taken a long time. I'm coming up to 6 years of the Creative Pen, and so none of this stuff is fast, but I feel like I'm incredibly lucky to be living the life of a full-time author, entrepreneur, and Barcelona last week. And next week, I'll be in New York for Thriller Fest, which I'm also excited about because I have a day at the FBI. I'm so excited, you can hear that. I'm just totally thrilled about it. So it's as part of Thriller Fest, a number of authors get to go to the FBI headquarters in New York, and we're not allowed to take anything electronic, so there will be no photos, but I'll be taking lots of notes and things, and I'll be doing like a roundup on my blog of everything to do with Thriller Fest. I'm also doing a Mastercraft Fest day, and actually my tutor will be David Morrell, so I'm quite excited about that. And I will be on a panel, which I'm also excited about because I'm obviously an indie author, and yet I'm on a panel with there's nothing about how I publish, I'm just on a panel with other authors, so that's really cool. And I'm going to loads of talks and things, and that will just be fantastic. Love Thriller Fest. It is an expensive conference, but boy is it worth it. I feel like I get so much from it in terms of learning, but also meeting other authors and encouragement, and just a glimpse of the Saturday night kind of gala dinner where they do awards. You know, there are a lot of big name authors there, and it's great to see, you know, these sort of lifetime author awards. It's going to be Anne Rice, who's going to be getting a Thriller Master Award this year. She of many vampire books and a long career as an author, and it just helps to look ahead. I'm 40 next year, which I'm excited about. I'm trying to think of what I want to do to mark that occasion, and I think ahead and think, okay, what is my career going to be like at 50, at 60, at 70, and hopefully 80 and 90 as well. I look at P.D. James is one of my sort of idols. I think she's 92 or something now, still writing, maybe 82. Anyway, this is a career we can do until the day we cark it, basically. So yeah, I do sound very excited. I am very excited. I've also excitingly redesigned jfpen.com, and what's so funny is I've spent the last few months, I've been wanting to redesign it for ages, and I tried loads of different themes, and I've spent loads of time just thinking about design issues and what I want and blah blah blah, and in the end I decided to stop procrastinating, stop being ridiculous about perfectionism, and I've actually gone with a similar design to the Creative Pen, but with the dark kind of my dark fiction colours, and also with language specific email lists. So I'm very happy to now have an email list for Espanol and Deutsch as well. So that's quite exciting, and there'll be Italiano hopefully in the next couple of months. Okay, so let's get on with I was going to say that the next podcast interview before we get into the next show will be with Elizabeth Hyde Stevens, author of Make Art, Make Money: Lessons from Jim Henson on Fueling Your Creative Career. And that's going to be a fantastic interview. It's a great book, Elizabeth's book. So if you want to read that, Make Art, Make Money, that will be next week's, or in the next sort of 10 days, podcast. And I'm so looking forward to talk to Elizabeth. And of course, Jim Henson, who created the Muppets. You know, amazing. Right, the podcast is sponsored by Kobo Writing Life. So here's a word from our sponsor, and then we'll be right into the interview.
Hi, Creative Pen listeners. This is Mark Lefebvre, Director of Self-Publishing and Author Relations at Kobo. Wanted to tell you a little bit about Kobo Writing Life, which you can find at kobo.com/writinglife. It is the free do-it-yourself platform for getting your books published into Kobo's catalog. One of the reasons why you may want to log in directly to Kobo Writing Life rather than coming through a third-party aggregator is that it gives you tighter control over your books. One of the things you can use for tighter control is the ability to set your price in 8 different currencies, take advantage of pre-orders, and schedule price promotions. Lots of great opportunities available for Kobo Writing Life, and you can learn a little bit more at kobowritinglife.com. And now back to your host, Joanna Penn.
Hi everyone, I'm Joanna Penn from thecreativepen.com, and today I'm here with David Morrell. Welcome, David.
Hi, Joanna. It's good to see you again.
Oh, yeah. It's so good to have you on the show. So just as a bit of an introduction, David is the multi-award winning and many times best-selling author of 35 books, as well as many short stories, essays and collaborations that have sold millions of copies and are available in so many languages. It's very hard to introduce David.
I'm Rambo's daddy. You have to remember Rambo.
That's what I was about to say. Your first novel, First Blood, became the Rambo franchise. And your latest novel is Murder as a Fine Art, a historical thriller. And today we're also talking about your latest book for writers, The Successful Novelist, recently updated. So lots to talk about. But let's start. David, you've written so many books across multiple genres. But what are the themes that you keep returning to over and over again? What are your obsessions?
And well, before I answer that, remember, this is my 42nd year as a published author. So if I didn't have a sizable bibliography, we would say, what have I been doing for 42 years? So that accounts for a lot of what I've been doing. I have a couple of themes. And they date back. People say, well, why do you write thrillers? I have a doctorate in American literature. Yeah. I was a professor at the University of Iowa in the English department. And people sometimes kind of snootily say, if that's a word, say, you know, why do you write thrillers? And I'm reminded of something that Stephen King said about writing horror, which is, what makes you think I have a choice? And it goes back to when I was young. My father died in the war, and my mother was forced for a time to put me in an orphanage. She couldn't support me as a single mother. And then she remarried. And the man she married was not, he didn't like children. And there was a lot of fighting in the house, and my parents argued all the time. And I was in fear for much of my early years. And what I did when I went to bed is I put pillows under the covers as if I were, it's like in a prison movie, you know, and they're breaking out and they stuff the pillows up. And I then went under the bed and I slept under the bed. And in my fear, I told myself stories in which I was, we're talking 4 years, 5 years, 6 years old. And I told myself stories in which I was the hero and rescuing people or whatever, in effect, rescuing myself. And so in a way, I was hardwired from when I was very young to be a thriller author. And one of my themes is that, and I learned this the hard way as I was growing up. I won't bore you with all the stuff that went wrong in my life, but it was a rough upbringing. And it occurred to me that, you know, life is, this is not news, but it's worth remembering that life is a very unpredictable affair and things can go wrong quickly. And so my themes, one of them at least, a constant one, is it doesn't hurt to be aware of what's going on around you. And interestingly, when I was a professor, one of my authors I loved teaching was Henry James, because that was his theme, awareness, that we had an obligation to become more and more aware. So, of course, Henry James is not a thriller author, but I'm taking that theme and applying it in another way. And I gravitate toward professionals, people whose business it is to be aware and whose lives depend upon them being aware. But the hope is that non-professionals, so to speak, reading my work will apply these lessons. There's a book called The Gift of Fear by Gavin De Becker. It's a one, you know the book?
Yeah.
Everyone should read it. And, you know, as De Becker says, you know, we have all these signals coming at us all the time, and some people choose to ignore them and get, you know, mugged or have their car stolen or terrible stuff. Because in the, later they say, you know, I kind of knew there was something wrong there, but I thought, oh, heck, it doesn't matter. Well, when you feel that, it does matter. And basically, that's what my books are about, The Gift of Fear.
Mm. And on that subject, I mean, in terms of your research as a professional, you've done a lot of professional training as well. You are a thriller author who is pretty thrilling. So tell us about some of the research stuff you've done and some of the exciting adventures you've had.
Well, I did a novel called Testament, which was about a man on the run from a terrorist organization who's forced to live in the mountains and over a winter. And I went to the library. This is long ago, you know, when you couldn't get information as readily on the internet. So I went to the library, and what I was reading, you know, how do you survive in the wilderness? It wasn't persuasive. And I heard about an organization called the National Outdoor Leadership School, which is based in Lander, Wyoming, in the United States, and basically takes groups into the mountains and teaches them how to survive up there. And so prior to writing Testament, I went and I lived above timberline in the Rocky Mountains for 30 days. And the graduation exercise, I remember this so vividly, is how long can you, there's a mantra, you can go 3 minutes without air, 3 hours without heat, 3 days without water, and 3 weeks without food. And so they said, we're going to take away we packed our food in. You can't scavenge in the mountains unless you're hunting or fishing, because the nuts and berries that you're eating aren't enough to sustain you given the effort you're putting out to get the nuts and berries. It's a minus deal. So they took our food away, and they said 3 days from now, and then they showed us the map, and it was on the other side of the Continental Divide. 3 days from now, we'll pick you up over here. So you had to know how to use a compass and a map. We kept our canteen, but we didn't have any food. And basically for 3 days, as if there were five of us in this particular group. And so we just kept going and kept going. And I lost 25 pounds. It was kind of interesting when we were done and we got there. We did find where they picked us up. Otherwise, God knows what would have happened. And they came and they had this big spread of all this food. And I thought, this does not feel right. I haven't eaten anything for 3 days and they're giving me hamburgers. I don't think so. And I think that was part of the lesson, you know. And I chewed on a banana for like 2 hours. And these guys that were eating the hamburgers, in half an hour they were throwing up in the ditch because their whole system had shut down. So I did that. That was an exciting thing. I went to the Bill Scott Raceway in West Virginia, where the many government people go to learn how to drive in emergency situations. I'm using government as a code for all kinds of places. And so for 5 days, I learned how to car fight, how to ram through barricades. And at 50 miles an hour, we were doing all this stuff. And the movies have it all wrong. But it was a glorious time. I never had so much fun doing all this car fighting on this raceway. And I used that in a novel called The Protector, because it occurred to me that car chases in the movies are fake, and I hardly ever see them in novels. So I thought, well, why not do a car chase in a novel that's authentic in the way a professional would really do it? And I think the one that really transported me the most, I was doing a novel called The Shimmer, which is about mysterious lights that appear in West Texas and have been for like 1889. And they're real. I've seen them. They're very strange. And the government, or the military for a time, and tried to investigate him using aircraft. So I knew that the novel, if it was going to be realistic, would have to use aircraft. And then I thought, well, what do I know about aircraft? And I'm not going to fake that. It's like, you know, if you're writing about guns, it helps to go out and shoot one just so you know what it's like. And so I went, I live in Santa Fe, New Mexico, and I went down to the local airport and found a place that taught flying. So I started taking flying classes, and I liked it so much that I eventually became a private pilot. So I have my license, which has the Wright brothers on it, and very cool. I've had a lot of fun doing the research.
You have, and I think you're my example. So I say to my husband, well, you know, David, you learned all this stuff and went to go do car chases, so I have to as well. And in fact, we went to...
Sure, absolutely.
Well, we went to Budapest and went to a Soviet bunker and shot a lot of guns.
Yes. People don't... I mean, you know, there's a reason why people, why gun enthusiasts are so enthusiastic. It's fun to shoot guns. I mean, that's... But, you know, people, you know, there are other issues to do with it, but we won't get into that.
Yeah, we won't go there. But what's interesting, so a lot of your books have, you know, the technology, the speed, the car chases. Your latest book, Murder is a Fine Art, is a little bit different, isn't it? Tell us about that book.
Well, it's set in 1854 London, and I remember when I first proposed the subject to a couple of author friends, they were horrified, because here's somebody known for contemporary American, more or less. I've written international thrillers, but American subjects, and after all, First Blood and Rambo, and I'm saying that I want to go to 1854 London. And part of this was that I'm sort of disillusioned with the opportunities in novels using contemporary settings. I feel as if I've done it a lot, and I wanted a fresh perspective, and I fell in love with a real person from the period named Thomas De Quincey, who was the first person to write about drug addiction in a book called Confessions of an English Opium Eater. He anticipated Freud's theories by a half century and invented the word subconscious. And he saw, I love to quote him, he saw the mind as filled with chasms and sunless abysses, with secret chambers in which alien natures could live undetected. I thought, oh, isn't that cool? And he was an expert in murder. He was fascinated by the first publicized mass murders in English history, the Ratcliffe Highway slayings of 1811. He wrote a famous blood-soaked essay called On Murder, Considered as One of the Fine Arts. And I thought, okay, that's my title, Murder is a Fine Art. And it'll be about him and those killings. It was just, the idea was so exciting. And then I said to myself, wait a minute, I don't know anything about 1854 London. I mean, yes, I was raised in Canada, so I'm born and raised, so I'm sort of a Commonwealth citizen, but that doesn't make me, you know, what am I going to do? So in my method acting way, for 2 years, I'm not lying here, 2 years, all I read were books related to 1854 London, either histories or contemporary. There are lots of memoirs from the period or novels from the period, you know, Dickens and what have you, and certainly De Quincey. De Quincey has thousands and thousands of pages, and I read his again and again because I wanted, someone said that I'd become a ventriloquist for him. Because after a while he was, I mean, I feel I'm reincarnated. I mean, Thomas De Quincey squirming around inside me. And finally, you know, I got so, it's like in a Richard Matheson novel, like Midtime Return or Jack Finney in Time and Again, where I actually felt I was there. And I have a map on my wall over here of 1851 London, and I can get around on that as if I lived there. And once I knew, I love to say this, once I knew how much a woman's clothes weighed in 1854, middle class, upper class, not a shop girl, the answer is the clothes weighed 37 pounds. And why did they weigh 37 pounds? Because they wore these outrageous hoop skirts with these either whale teeth or metal underneath, and though that wide surface had to be covered with cloth, and the cloth, 10 yards of satin and undergarments and weights to keep the skirt down, and what nonsense, it amounted to 37 pounds if you do the math. So anyhow, it was just a joy, and the response was so good that I've written a second one that'll be coming out called Inspector of the Dead.
Wow, you certainly go deep in your research, don't you?
I am a method actor writer. I must get into the role. I must feel that I'm there.
Mm. And
it takes time, mind you.
Yeah, and I mean, I love research too. We're off to Barcelona on Monday to start some research on another book. And is that the bit you like best? I mean, what of the writing process do you like best?
Oh, it's a combination of things. Obviously, there's that excitement when an idea seizes you, creeps up on you. And, you know, people, you know, where do you get your ideas? Well, it's for me, it's always when I'm not looking. It's, you know, something says, and I say, well, that's kind of interesting. And, of course, it's what I call civilians, non-writers. You know, they'll say, oh, that's interesting, and go on about their day. But a writer will say, I wonder why that's so interesting. Let me make a few notes. And if it sticks, you know, the next day and the day after that, the next thing you know, you're writing. And then, of course, people say write what you know about. But, you know, I kind of think that it's more fun to pick a topic I want to know about and then research the hell out of it and then write the book. And that way I have this rule, which is that life being so short. And I mentioned earlier about the precariousness. You know, my son died when he was 15 from a very rare bone cancer. He was in the hospital for like 6 months. He lost this entire part of his rib cage to surgery and died anyhow. And my granddaughter, Natalie, died from the same rare bone cancer. And only 200 people get that disease each year in the United States. So, you know, I have seen, you know, this, you know, I've learned that the most precious thing we have is time. So I won't write a book simply because I think it'll sell copies. I mean, I'm not a dimwit, right? I mean, obviously that's in the equation, but I have three requirements. And one is that there must be something about the theme of the book, the situation, which, as I write it, will make me understand myself better. And the second is that there's something about the research that will add to me as well, that I'll become a fuller person because of the research. And the third is there has to be something about the way the book is written that will engage me, that I'll have the feeling that I'm moving the idea of what a thriller can be forward instead of doing what I've done or what, you know, a lot of other people have done. I think I told you my mantra, which is be a first-rate version of yourself rather than a second-rate version of another writer. And so that's, you know, that's sort of the rule I follow.
Mm. No, which is brilliant. And then in The Successful Novelist, you talk about your process for writing a book, including this written conversation with yourself, which I love. Tell us a bit about that.
Well, again, ideas come from the strangest sources. I wonder if anybody even remembers Harold Robbins, you know, the Carpetbaggers and the Adventurers, and they had great titles. And, you know, a trashy international, I don't even know what to call them. I read, they're fun. But one evening during his fame, who remembers him anymore? This is another example of you write to be famous, good luck. You know, because in this country, a famous politician was dethroned yesterday. And, you know, I say, all right, you know, it comes and it goes. So in any case, you know, you don't want to do it for the fame. You want to do it because there are, going back to Harold Robbins, he talked to his typewriter. He would go in and sit down out before computers. He'd say, oh, hello, Doris, whatever her name was, and how are you today? And Doris would say, now imagine this. He thinks the typewriter's talking back to him. Well, Harold, it's been I just can't wait for you to keep writing, you know, that story you told me yesterday. So exciting. Oh, well, Doris, thank you. Yes, I had a few ideas. And you know, so he went, that's how he wrote. And then he's telling the story to Doris, the typewriter. So I got to thinking, what if I wrote letters to myself, conversations, whatever we want to call them, in which I would, in a conversation with myself, and this is almost schizophrenic, discuss ideas. You know, it would be like, well, David, what are we doing here? And I'd say, well, I have this idea for a novel about this guy named Thomas De Quincey. And so then the other part of me would say, well, what's so special about Thomas De Quincey? And then I would answer that question. And so I'm constantly prodding myself. Why is this interesting? Who would care? You know, why would you bother doing this? That kind of question. And sometimes these written conversations have gone on for 10 and 20 single space pages. And the advantage of it is that you don't talk out the idea into the ozone as you would say with a friend or a spouse or a partner or whoever. You know, have you got an idea? Yes, I do. And let me tell you about it. And when you're all done, you don't want to write the darn thing. So, but if you've written it on paper, it's a different process. And the advantage of doing this also is that in the long run, let's say, you know, life being what it is, you get sick, or a major catastrophe occurs, when you can come back to that written conversation and pick it up just and be reprimed just as when you first wrote it. So I've found it to be very helpful for myself and people who have read The Successful Novelist. That's the chapter that most people want to talk to me about.
It's actually the first time I've heard of that particular technique.
It's just me and Harold Robbins. That's all I can tell you.
No more. It'll be everyone now.
It's everyone. Well, the people read the book, but, you know, it gets around.
Yeah, no, and it's a really good tip. Now, I wanted to ask you about the screenwriting and the whole Rambo thing, because obviously, well, I guess many writers, you know, hear Rambo and they kind of think, oh, wow, you know, that movie must have been like the pinnacle of everything, and getting a movie deal is the best thing ever for an author. Can you talk a bit about that, you know, that process and what you learned about authors and movies?
Well, It was a long process. First Blood, my first novel, I'm still amazed that it's in print 42 years later. It's never been out of print, and people talk about the movies as if they were yesterday. There's a theater here. I live in Santa Fe, New Mexico, and at the end of this month, June, I'm going to be introducing a screening of First Blood here in Santa Fe at a local theater, and a question and answer afterward. The novel came out in 1972, and a producer named Lawrence Terman, who had co-produced The Graduate, was approached about it through my agent. And he liked it a lot. And he went to Columbia Pictures, where Richard Brooks, a writer-director I deeply admire, was hired to adapt and direct. After a year, I don't know what Brooks turned in. I don't know what the script was, but Columbia immediately sold it to Warner Brothers. And Warner Brothers hired Martin Ritt for a time, or at least approached him to see if he would direct it. And Ritt had worked a lot with Paul Newman, so it looked as if Newman would be in the picture playing the police chief, not Rambo. And that fell apart. Then Sidney Pollack, another director I admire, was hired to direct Steve McQueen. And this was a go project with McQueen. And then somebody remembered that McQueen was 45 years old, and that in 19, it would have been 75. There were no 45-year-old guys coming back from Vietnam. That was a young person's war, unlike what's happening in Afghanistan and Iraq, where most of those people are 45, 50 years old. So it went through, ultimately, 6 studios, 26 scripts. Michael Douglas was approached, I forget all else. And then finally, Andy Vanya, Andrew Vanya, as they say on the film, and Mario Casar, two distributors, wanted to make a movie. They had a company called Carolco. So they approached Sylvester Stallone, who had never had a hit in anything except Rocky. It was considered very risky. And Stallone himself said it was going to be the most popular home movie ever made. He didn't think anybody would go to see it, but, you know, to the contrary. So that picture came out 10 years after the book was published. So I had had a lot of time to be seasoned. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, I've seen people go crazy by having, you know, movies and whatever. I mean, I really have. They become different people. But, you know, I mean, I thought it was exciting. I won't deny that. And I was very flattered for the U.S. Blu-ray DVD of First Blood. I was asked to do a full-length audio commentary, which, like, asking the author, there's something wrong there. What made them think of doing that? So it was all very exciting, and the character, of course, has interpreted different ways by different people. It was politicized in this country, in the United States. Ronald Reagan, when he was president, invoked Rambo a lot in his speeches. And he once said, and I cringed, he said, "I saw a Rambo movie the other night. Now I know what to do the next time there's a terrorist hostage crisis." And I couldn't tell if he was kidding or what, you know. You just have to laugh, you know. But the best story I heard about Rambo, I was in Poland on a publicity tour, and I received an unusual amount of press attention, a lot of media, more than was right, more than this didn't make any sense to me. And a very nice woman journalist, she said, "You're confused, aren't you?" And I said, "Yeah, I don't know. What's why?" They were interviewing me for 3 days, 12 hours a day. And they were just stacked up to me. And I said, "What's that about?" And she said, "Well, you have to understand the solidarity years here. And the Rambo movies were illegal, but pirated copies were smuggled in." And she, referring to herself as a demonstrator, she said, "Groups such as mine watched the movies dressed up as Rambo and went out and demonstrated against the Russian soldiers." And so she said, you know, with a smile, she said, "So in a small way, Rambo helped bring down the Soviet Union." And I thought, all right, this is cool. We can put that on my tombstone, although I'm not ready to go yet, but we could consider that.
Wow. I think one of the big things from reading the chapter and hearing you talk is that how much out of the author's control the whole thing gets. As in, it could have been nothing. It could have been the expensive home movie, but it's become a film that people, you know, teenagers now still know, even though it was, you know, way before they were born. It's amazing.
The picture gets first blood. The others are of varying quality. The second one is kind of a comedy. It's sort of a Western Tarzan. It's, you know, Rambo of the jungle. I don't know what you'd call it. And, you know, the fight in the helicopter is like the fight on the stagecoach in a Western, you know. And the third one's a mess by any standard. It's just not a very good film. The fourth one has good and bad stuff to it. The middle, I gather, was eviscerated by the producers. But the first one has aged well. And if you think again about changing society, I mean, who could have predicted this? At the time of the Vietnam War, returning Vietnam veterans were literally spat upon. They were insulted. They were called baby killers, and they were being confused with the political policies that sent them to war. Military personnel are servants of the government. And one of the things that their First Blood did, it was to change people's perception of not only Vietnam veterans, but also of all returning veterans. And it's pretty much acknowledged that, you know, the sympathy that Rambo's character created in, and because of Sylvester Stallone's eyes particularly, you don't have that happening anymore. And people became sophisticated enough to understand that the military personnel and the politicians, it's, you know, there's a dischunk there. So, you know, it's been a ride, you know, to have created a character that changed society. And as you say, though, you know, I call it like two different train tracks. You know, there's the novel and then what happened with the films. And because First Blood's a pretty good film, I certainly am not going to, complain. That's why I call myself Rambo's father. I'm Rambo's daddy. I like to kid around with that because it's like a character that grows up and goes his way, and it's out of my control what'll happen, but it's certainly interesting to watch how it happened.
Yeah, and just as a follow-up to that, are there any things, you know, that authors should watch out for with movie contracts in particular? Because you do cover that in the book.
There is, yes. First of all, make sure that you have payment for sequels and prequels and remakes. That this is in the contract, and that if I have profit participation in the Rambo films, and they actually paid. I mean, you know, the joke in the movie business is that profits are like the horizon. They recede infinitely. But I actually got money from the Rambo films. And so make sure you have, even if it looks meaningless, profit participation. But the, more than that, from the point of view of us as writers, have a clause in the contract that says you have the exclusive right to for prequels, sequels. If you want to do a remake of your novel, update it, that you have the exclusive right to do that, and that no one can write novelizations or, you know, plots based upon the characters in the movie, the characters that you created. I mean, I see television shows where you have, I see paperbacks using those characters, and I'm pretty confident that the creator of those characters is not getting money from those books. So, you know, make sure you have the control, and it's pretty simple, the exclusive right to write, that's the right there gets a little awkward, but to create or sequels, prequels, remakes, whatever, you know, that no one else can do it. It's pretty important.
Mm. It's a really good chapter, and I think everyone should read that, because it's one of those things when, you know, a lot of authors are so grateful when they get someone going, oh, we're thinking of a movie, but you just never know. So you have to protect your rights. I mean, that's just a big deal. And on that sort of, on just following up on the how important rights are, how do you see the difference between being an author and running a business as an author?
Well, this is, when I started in 1972, nobody talked this way. There were no book signings. None of what we take for granted. Of course, it wasn't the internet then, but I mean, I remember when I received a postcard one day in 1972, and it had blood on it, okay? I mean, the word blood. And I honestly thought it was from the Red Cross asking me to go to a local hospital and give blood for a blood drive. And I put the postcard up, and I do give blood. So I thought, all right, I'll try to remember that, and I'll get over there. And about a half an hour later, I said, you know, there's something strange about that postcard. So I went back, and it was for my novel. It was for First Blood. And, you know, it was a card they sent out to reviewers. And this was considered so avant-garde. Oh, my God, they sent postcards out. Oh, what genius, you know. And now, of course, it's like skywriting, you know. I mean, you say, what were they thinking? And so I lived through, you know, I remember when the author tour started in the mid-1980s and then became, you know, sort of, I mean, people have to do it, but it's hardly as fresh as it. And then, you know, what's happening in the internet. And of course, you're my guru when it comes to how to market books, especially on the internet. It's become a source of frustration for me. And I try to think of what I tell my writing students is we have an obligation to write the most interesting, meaningful, moving, dramatic story we possibly can, one that we are driven to write. And again, remembering what I said earlier about time is all we have. So why waste it chasing the market, which you always fall behind on, as opposed to writing something that's meaningful for you and at least is worth doing from a personal perspective. And so that's what I do. And then, okay, that's done, ka-dunk, it's over here, and now I have to turn into a different kind of person in order to promote the books. Now, there was a time when I invoked Arnold Schwarzenegger. I know this gets really weird. Schwarzenegger, like 20 years ago, 15 years ago, said that he felt that he should put in one-tenth of the time promoting a film that he was for making it. And he, putting all things together, he was willing to devote a month to promoting. Well, lots of luck, Arnold, right? Because that's like, that's skywriting again. I mean, now, every day I get up and I'm doing an hour of, you know, trying to make people aware of my books. It's talking about Facebook, for example. I'm not cynical about Facebook. I believe that the only reason Facebook works is if we are honest about what we're doing and the things that are interesting to us. And I hardly ever talk about my own work. I talk about the books I'm reading or authors whom I admire, whom I have met, and things like that. I do, however, when I have a book come out, and such as the trade paperback of Murder is a Fine Art, which just came out. So, you know, I promote that, but it's there are other, you know, so we have Twitter, we have, you know, a number of other things, and it's difficult to balance things. And on another occasion, you and I were talking about how you do it, because you're so much better at it than anybody I know. And I don't know what the answer is, because the writing is the key.
Well, I think you said it there. It's about sort of splitting that every day and doing a bit on, you know, every morning I get up and I put on Antisocial, which is a really good app on the computer. It turns off. It turns off everything else.
All right, I like that.
So what's so great for people, I think, is to hear that you, who've got 40-odd years experience, still struggle with this balance question. So that it's very encouraging. But I wanted to just move on. I recently read your novella, The Architecture of Snow, which is lovely. And it's about a manuscript from a reclusive writer and an editor's attempt to get the rights from him. And the subtext suggests huge changes in the publishing industry. So I wondered if you could talk about what do you think about big publishing now, and what have you seen change over your time?
Well, the Architecture of Snow is imagines that a writer like J.D. Salinger would out of nowhere send a manuscript to an editor, and a young editor, the former editor is dead, and this young editor, and it's under a pseudonym, so it takes them a while to figure out who this guy is, and you know what, how, as you say, how much the business has changed, and how they would now market something by J.D. Salinger, or it's another name in the story, and what we're experiencing, this started approximately 1999 when the big media companies began buying up publishers. When I was starting in 1972, no lie, there were about 40 independent book publishers in New York City, and these were not small presses. And over the years, they got scooped up until now we have, I lose count on whether it's 5 or 6. It seems to change a lot. And then, of course, Amazon, meanwhile, has you know, risen. It was powerful to begin with, but then because of the ebook revolution, which started in 2009, it's hard to believe it's only been 5 years, gained a status as both a publisher and a distributor. And some people are no doubt aware of the contest that's going on, the dispute between Amazon and Hachette, and I am a Hachette author through Mulholland Books, no one knows the specifics of the discussion, but what we do know is that Little Brown Books, Mulholland Books, Hachette Books are no longer, if they're a new book about to be published, they are not for sale on Amazon. And about 1,000 authors have been affected. Now, clearly, this dispute will be resolved. But we have now 4 or 5 other major conglomerates that must then come to terms with whatever deal Hachette and Amazon come to terms with. And, you know, if being a novelist, a person, you know, who uses imagination, I conceive of a day when the only publisher will be Amazon and the only distributor will be Amazon. It all depends on how you look at this in terms of competition. The people who are published by Amazon, and I have many ebooks published through Amazon. I mean, they have been, as do you, Amazon has been a huge boon for authors. But so we're in this very, very complex, everything changes. And our task as authors is how to adapt. And I foresee a time when authors will be a lot like, and many of them are a lot like musicians, singers, and musical groups who have their own website, who are their own boss, and are, you know, perhaps making distribution deals over here. But that, you know, I mean, this could conceivably be the start of authors no longer wanting to be with big publishers because of this glitch. I mean, I mentioned a while ago that the sequel to Murder is a Fine Art, Inspector of the Dead, will come out next year. That's 2 years of my life. I mean, deep research, deep commitment. That's all I did for 2 years. If that book had been coming out today, it would have been disastrous for me. And so it's now making me wonder about, what is the relationship between an author and a publisher and a distributor? And I love that Mulholland Books has been glorious to me. The editorial help I've been advice, conversations, whatever we'd like to call them, have just been marvelous. Their promotion, they're wonderful promoters. I have no complaints at all. But, you know, it's this situation is it's. So interesting in the abstract to see how it's playing out.
Mm. And at the end of the day, it does seem like a power differential. As the author, if you have the power to reach readers, like you have so many readers who love your books, you can reach them directly, as can I. And we can now sell directly from our websites, as you're saying, like right. musicians do. But anyway, I don't want to go down that because I've only got a few more minutes with you. So I want, as a final question, you say in the book, and I quote, "The profession is not for the weak-willed or the faint of heart." So yes. I wondered, what are the keys to longevity in this business, both in mindset and work ethic?
Well, it's long view. I mean, you know, I've been doing this for 42 years, and I've always tried to think. You can't predict, but I've always tried to imagine it's 5 years later. Not so much in the circumstances, but in terms of my time frame. A career is peaks and valleys. And anybody who goes into it expecting that every year, you know, that it'll always go like this is foolish. I'm reminded of one of my favorite authors is Stephen Hunter. A point of impact. He's really an excellent action writer. And he had what I think is his best book, A Pale Horse Riding or Coming. Now I see he's one of my favorite authors. I can't remember, but it's Pale Horse. And that book was published just as the World Trade Center was attacked. And the people don't remember, but I do, that for 6 months, New York publishers refused to even think about publishing thrillers. If you had a thriller coming out or were submitting a thriller, you were out of luck. And I thought of all the people who write thrillers, perhaps because they think it's a hot market. And I'm going to be so successful. But again, you know, stuff happens. And you have to put your faith in the work rather than, you know, thinking about, I'm going to be so successful. And if the success happens, hooray. And if, you know, you can work and work and work and you're ideally, it will pay off. But that doesn't mean that it necessarily will. So I'm always committed to the work without thinking that it's going to make me, you know, I know so many people who write for money and so many people who write for fame. And, okay, I can see for the money. For the fame, what? What is that about? Why would you be so nuts just to want to be famous? I mean, it's so shallow. And you know, if those are your motives, then you're going to be set up for disappointment. But if you're writing because you're writing the best book you can, then I think that's the way to get through it all.
Fantastic. Just tell people where they can find you and your books online.
I'm davidmorell.net. I couldn't get the .com because there was a guy who's a photographer. And more power to them. But so I have, I call it my network of readers, right? davidmorell.net. It's like a magazine. There's a lot of photographs, a lot of information, and I think it's entertaining. And then there are ways then to go to my Facebook page, and I'm on Facebook every day. And it's like I start the day, because I follow it, as I said earlier, I'm not cynical about Facebook. I learn a lot about what people that I care about are doing. So I go on and each morning and I reply to, you know, things that people have said on. So that's another way to pay attention to find me. And the link to that is on my website. And my publisher, Mulholland Books, has a page for my books there. But it's all really essentially on davidmorell.net, and you can go from there.
Oh, thank you so much for your time, David. That was brilliant.
Oh, well, it's always good to see you, Joanna. And as I said, I admire your fiction, and at the same time, I think that what you're doing to help people with marketing skills is extraordinary as well.
Thanks for listening today. I hope you found it helpful. You might also like the backlist episodes at thecreativepen.com/podcasts. You can also get your free Author 2.0 blueprint at thecreativepen.com/blueprint. If you'd like to connect, you can tweet me at thecreativepen or find me on Facebook at thecreativepen. See you next time.